My name's Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. Some of you showed up after I sat down, and a lot of you here. Could I see the hands of the newcomers again, please? People in their first 30 days of sobriety. Good to see you, a bunch of you. Welcome. I want to thank Bob for inviting me to come over today. We've had a good day today, and life was good. I am going to, as always, look at my watch while I'm talking. I don't do that to see what time it is. I do that to give those of you that are worried about it a sense of optimism that I care what time it is. I don't really care, but I want you to relax. For the newcomers, there are no authorities in Alcoholics Anonymous. We all just share our experience, strength, and hope. We insist, most of us, that the only real authority other than loving God, as he expresses himself to us, is the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I'm asked to speak, I make up stuff and say that it's in the big book in order to add credibility to my talk. I give page numbers and nobody ever checks. I also, you know, you guys know the drums, but I hadn't seen them since in the canyon in Oklahoma, I think. It's been that long ago. It's good to see them. Norm Alpey used to say he comes here to see some old friends and make new ones, and I've done that tonight. I've made a new friend, and I've seen some old ones. So we got that done. I was born in Los Angeles, California, 1,200 years ago. And I don't remember living in California when I was a kid. The first home I remember was in a little town in Kansas, about 45 miles southwest of Wichita. We thought we were in the Bible Belt. When I got away from there, I found out everybody thinks they're in the Bible Belt. You know, well, Californians don't think they are. They know they are not in the Bible Belt, but they're happy about that, too, you know. So nobody knows where the Bible Belt is, but I know it buckles about 45 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas, in the Methodist Church, where I began to learn about life. While I was in that town, I saw a travelogue movie when I was a little kid on training wild elephants in India. And they start out by putting a rope around the elephant's right front leg, a baby elephant, and then they tied it up to a huge tree, and the elephant fights and pulls and tugs and fights and pulls and tugs until his experience causes him to come to believe that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. Then they go ahead with the rest of the elephant's training. In the movie, they showed this big elephant pushing trees over. They hooked the tree up to his harness, and he pulled the tree out of the forest for harvest. And at the lunch break, in order to hold the elephant where they wanted him, they put a rope around his right front leg, and they drove a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground that when they wrapped that rope around the stake and the elephant walked around and he got to the end of the rope, he just stopped pulling. He just began, and the rope didn't hold him. The stake didn't hold him. The limiting belief that they imposed on the elephant while he was a baby is what held the elephant. And when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous just a few months, I listened to Don Gates talk, and on the way he said something that reminded me of of the baby elephant, and I realized I come to Alcoholics Anonymous with approximately 157 and 2,000 beliefs, just like the stake in the ground, just like the rope. And I didn't know I believed this. Yet it had a profound effect on my life. One of the things that had the most profound effect was that I was taught in the Methodist Church that I was separate from God. God was an anthropomorphic being up in heaven behind the pearly gates on the streets of gold. And I was in this little Kansas town, so I knew I was separate from God. I was taught that God created the universe, but he was a miracle worker. And I was taught just to pray. I didn't know I was taught, but I was taught to just to pray for miracles. The first time we prayed, and I knew who I was praying to and what I was praying for, was for it not to rain. Because wheat harvest started the next day, and there's a lot of reasons, if you're a farmer cutting wheat, that you don't want the field wet. And so we prayed Sunday fervently for it not to rain. It rained Sunday afternoon. It hailed Sunday afternoon. The wind blew and destroyed all the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas, Sunday afternoon. And nobody pointed the finger at me, but I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't doing what you have to do to have God answer your prayer. I knew I wasn't, and I thought all the rest of you guys were. And if you're 4 or 5 years old and you've assumed the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. The old ego, assuming more responsibility than you have the power to get done. And I learned to live my life that way. I learned to base my sense of well-being on me being able, like the little train that could, is to never give up and make it work. And never made me feel good. I never had the power and never knew it. And when I was about 12 years old, I drank about a half a pint of whiskey. And I solved the feeling good problem. I remember sitting there thinking, this is what they mean when they say, let's have a few drinks and get to feeling good. God, that was a good, I had never, ever had a feeling good feeling before. And now I had answered the problem for feeling satisfied and happy. Then I could really put some effort into straightening you people out so that you would do the right thing. And what was right was what I thought was right. And if you didn't think the way I thought, then it became very important to me that you know you're wrong. And I lived my life that way. And the funny thing, it doesn't work very well. But I just stuck with it. I met this beautiful red-headed girl when I was in the seventh grade, and I fell in love with her. I know in retrospect, I'm 74 years old now, and I know I loved her from when I first saw her. And she was my girlfriend for about 3 weeks. The summer between when we was in the seventh grade and eighth grade. And then she said, why do you get in so much trouble? They didn't do what I wanted them to do was the reason I got in trouble. But she stopped being my girlfriend. And I went through high school just obsessed with her, but I could never tell her. And I got in the Navy during the Korean War, and I heard that her and her fiancé broke up. And I knew I was a loser, but it dawned on me I was a loser. Now, a loser is somebody that will ask the girl to be his girlfriend. and gets told no. That's a loser. But a loser's loser is afraid to ask her. And I was a loser's loser. And as soon as I heard they had broken up, I put in for leave and I went home. And I had a couple of drinks, but I told her I loved her. And we went dancing. My sisters had taught me to dance. And it was, you just move your left foot away from your right foot about a foot, and then you move your right foot up with it. Then you put your left foot forward, and then your right foot forward, and then your right foot out, and your left foot to it. And it's called a box step. I got very good at it, but they get tired of it. And so I'd be doing this, and then I'd turn. Throw them off, and then we'd have to start over again. This night, I danced like Fred Astaire. It was that "See the Ocean from a Silver Plane." That was the song that they were. God, I danced to that beautifully. And I had learned some Shakespeare. I don't know what the hell was. Well, I just liked Shakespeare. Once I got out of school, I liked a lot of things that I didn't like that I should have liked in school. But I told her, "Did not the heavenly rhetoric of thine eyes, against whom all the world could not hold argument, persuade my heart to this?" She fell like a ton of brick. And we got married. We had a son in 11 months, and then we had another son, and then we had a daughter. And things were going pretty good for us. We moved, after I got out of Navy, we moved to San Diego, and I was working as a tool maker. It was a good job, and we were drinking, but there wasn't any big problems until about 1959. And I got a job as an entry-level engineer. The job title was process analyst. We analyzed processes. And I was good at this. But they want you to write a report. And I not only couldn't write a report, when I tried, I just seized up with anxiety and was immobilized. And I couldn't do it. And one Wednesday, I hadn't even started on the report, and I took it home to work on it at home. And just after dinner, the table was cleaned off, I sat down, and I just was immobilized with fear. And I knew I couldn't do it, you know. And I got up with no specific purpose in mind, but went to the refrigerator to see what was going on in there. And what was going on in there was a pint of whiskey that was about half gone of Jim Beam at the patio party. I was the captain of the neighborhood patio party. And I bought a beer called Edelweiss that you could get for a case of it for a buck and a quarter. And it would get you there. It just had a kind of a sour taste to it. And this neighbor of mine brought some whiskey over, which he drank at the patio party, and then he left the whiskey. And my wife put it in the refrigerator, going to give it to him, and I just poured myself about a double shot and put some ice in. I never drank during the week. Well, I did once in a while, but it was at a party or something, or at a bar, but not at home. But I went over and sat down again, and I started to sipping that whiskey, and all at once the thought occurred to me, you know, if I started out by explaining what prompted me to do this analysis to start with, that's the way I could start this report, and then I could briefly describe the significant analysis results. And as a conclusion, I could make recommendations based on the analysis results. And I got up and went to the refrigerator and got Bandy's whiskey and came back, and I wrote the best report that I had ever written. I discovered a technical vocabulary that I didn't know I had. That's the truth. This stuff just... And I wasn't drunk. I was smart. And I took the report to work. They typed it up. Everybody approved it that needed approving. The next week, at about Tuesday, my boss's boss brought the report out. And he said, "Howard, did you write this report?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "This is a good report." I said, "Thank you." He said, "We knew you could do it if you'd just give us the effort." Passed through my mind, effort. I gave you effort. It wasn't effort. It was whiskey. But it occurred to me, don't tell them whiskey. Let them think effort. They'll give you a raise for effort. They ain't going to give you anything for whiskey. But the important thing was I knew it was whiskey. And whiskey it was. And I solved the report writing problem, and I get little bigger and better assignments. So I discover in a little bit, you don't have to wait till Wednesday night to start this process. You can start it Monday night. And it's working, and I'm getting promotions, and you can start it any day at lunch. And then you can start it any time of any day. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon someplace. And I'm in trouble. Although I had been promoted from a process analyst to an engineer to a senior engineer, I moved to Hughes and Culver City as kind of a senior engineer, and I was promoted to an engineering manager. And that's not setting the world on fire, but that's a steady, progressive series of promotions that I got because I drank whiskey. And if I hadn't drank whiskey, I couldn't cut it. I tried it, and I couldn't cut it. And it's just that pretty soon I had to drink so much whiskey before I was smart that my speech was slurred and I was spilling things. And if you didn't know any better, you'd have thought I was drunk. My wife did. My boss did. And I just kept, you know, I could not stop. And you can't tell them. I could tell Pat, but I couldn't convince her. Pat needed Al-Anon when we were in the seventh grade. And she never heard of Al-Anon until I came to AA. So she was all, I bet you, I wish I'd have counted them, but let's just take a raw number. 1,000 times she was going to say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" How many of you alcoholics ever thought you had enough? It was, you know, of course I don't. I don't think I have enough. Let's have another one. And, in 1972, my boss demoted me, took me out of management, and said I'd lost credibility with him as a manager and with the people that I was supervising. And that's what you could call a bottom. And bottoms aren't bad for me. Bottoms are good for me. Once I was on bottom for a little while, it occurred to me that I was drinking too much. And I can't drink that much, but I can drink some more. I can drink a little. Then my wife was going to take the kids and leave me. "Don't leave me. I'll quit drinking. I won't drink at all." And about 4 days, I said, "We got to talk. I do not want you to leave me. I want you to stay here with the kids, and we'll make our lives work, and we'll make them wonderful. But if I can't drink at all, I guess you have to go." I told her that. You know, I had hoped it wouldn't come to that, but she stayed. She stayed. And I would say, "I'm just going to drink a half a pint a day. That's all I'm going to drink." In a little while, I had a convulsive seizure. My son took me to the doctor. By this time, you see, I was in so much trouble and I didn't know it. I didn't know I was in the trouble I was in at home. Pat had decided that the only solution to her problem is Howard is going to have to die. And Al-Anon, when she tells her story, they applaud then. She said, don't drink. Don't drink Thursday. We've got to go to this PTA thing. It's very important. And I don't know how I got so drunk. I had no idea getting that drunk, but I was drunk, and I was in the shower, and I was chewing my tongue because I thought if I pass out this time, I'm dying. I thought I was dying. And I did pass out, and I was sitting in the corner of the shower with the water running on me when she came in, and blood was running down my face. And she says, I thought, if he just keeps drinking, he's going to kill himself. I'm not going to have to kill him. And she stopped telling me to stop drinking. Now, they teach him that in Al-Anon. I don't know if any of you have had the experience of, she'd just get off my back. She was off my back. Now, if she would argue with me, as long as I could argue, I was right. And I believed I was right. But when she stopped arguing, I started believing I shouldn't be doing this, you know. And I was about $2,500 in debts that she didn't know about. And she paid the bills. And there was no money coming in to pay anything on this. But at work, I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before Hughes lost it. I gave it to a fence, and he was going to sell it. We were going to split the money. I gave it to the fence, and the only thing that split was the fence. And I got nothing. And I was sitting in the tattletale, the bar I drank at, 10 days later, and I was trying to sell one of those entrepreneurs some test equipment for their factory. And, I'm telling you, whiskey had stopped making me smart. The next morning when I woke up, I was on page 8 in the big book. I didn't know anything about the big book, but there were no words to express the bitter remorse that I experienced. And there was quicksand stretched out in every direction. And that is the bottom. When there is no bottom, there's the bottom. And the fact is, the equipment's gone. I don't know where in the hell it is, but I know it wasn't owned by Hughes. It was owned by the federal government. I know its value exceeds the amount that will require ultimately an investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigators. And I feel what it describes on page 30 is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. My kids, I'm a candidate for hard time in a federal penitentiary, and my kids are a candidate for the disgrace that goes with that. And I thought, I've got to stop drinking until this blows over. And I used to drink with a guy named Kenny Sixberry, who joined AA and became Kenny S. And he had become the president of AA worldwide. We got that information in the tattletale, and we always got it right in there. And I called Kenny and asked. I drank a half a pint that morning, and then I called him and asked him if he was still in AA. He said, yes. He said, are you drinking now? I said, no, which was the truth. I'd finished the half a pint, and I ain't drinking right now. He said, try not to drink anymore. Took me a long time to get it that he didn't believe me. I drank three more half a pints, which is what I did. And that day I took a lethal dose of a little number called Benzedrine. And so about 6:30, I thought, why did I call AA? Things are not that bad. I hope he don't come. But he came in a pickup truck with a motorcycle in the bed of the pickup truck, which was just the way I expected the president of AA worldwide to be coming. And I got in and I said, I am not an alcoholic. He said, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, Howard, but I think we're going to the right place. And he took me to the Culver City Studio Group, which is an old group in the West Side. And Kenny was a big, tall ex-Marine, a great guy. And he introduced me to this sour-pushed old guy. And he said, Frank, I want you to meet Howard. This is Howard's first meeting. And Frank looked up, and I didn't know it for a long, long time, but he looked up and smiled. It was hard to see him, tell him he was smiling. And he shook my hand, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, Howard. I hope you find what we have found. And if you do, we'll help you find it. And if you find it, you'll have a life magnitudes better than you ever dreamed. Now, I not only drank in the Tattletale, I studied philosophy in the Tattletale. We were philosophizers. We knew things like nothing is as easy as it looks. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong, and at the worst possible time. Put that up on the wall. Life sucks, and then you die. Put that on the wall. You know your Betty's so brave and true. Well, you get to him before he gets to you. Put it on the wall. You know. Don't trust anyone. Don't trust anyone. And I trusted Frank. I liked him. He's the son. I never smiled. But I believed him. I trusted him. Now, I was puzzled about why I did that when it was not my philosophy. Now, if I would have said to you, wonder why I trusted him, if you would have said, that's God's grace, Howard. God just slipped you enough grace so you could trust Frank and you'd join us. I would have said, who else can I talk to about what went on? I was convinced. I didn't know my baby elephant belief system, but in my baby elephant belief system, I did believe I was separate from God and there were no miracles coming. And God was a miracle worker or he was nothing. He was up in heaven, and if you just had to carry your cross, so to speak, and then you were going to go to hell, burn forever. Well, I disengaged from that in favor of drinking whiskey. And I know why I did. The whiskey worked, and the other didn't. And I knew it never would work. And I told Frank, and he said, "That's all right. Don't worry about that." And they had a guy named Chuck Ennis, who I think had 29 years when I first came to AA, and he passed away not very long ago with 50-some years. And Chuck worked at MGM as a film editor, and he talked about getting out of work and stopping by the backstage bar just to have two drinks, three at the most. Next thing you knew, it was the last call for alcohol. And he's arguing with the bartender, your clock is set fast, and I've got time for more to drink, and I'm going to take it. And he didn't want to go out into the parking lot because he had insulted some guy who he thought was out there going to straighten him out afterwards. And I thought, Jesus, I'm just like him. And he talked about doing it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every day. But every day he was just going to have two, three at the most. Until he came to AA and they told him what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a man or woman who has lost the ability to control their drinking. That the loss of control is characterized by an insane, obsessive belief each time we start to drink. That this time I'm going to have two, three at the most. This time I'm going to just baby this half a pint through the day. I drank four half a pints every day. Do you know why I drank half a pint? Because that was all I was going to drink, was the half a pint. And at the end of the day, there would be four, you know, well, I had told my wife that I was just going to drink a half a pint. So I would bring the fourth half a pint home, and in front of her, I would break the seal. Then I would take a drink. And I'd say, boy, it's a goddamn jungle out there today, you know. And I'd drink that half a pint, and I'd go to sleep on the floor. She calls it passing out. He can't even drink a half a pint. He's getting convulsive seizures and everything. I identified with you guys as you each got up and told your stories. And except I didn't remember craving a drink. And Kenny, I talked to Kenny at the break. And I said, I don't think I craved a drink. He said, what time did you start drinking? I said, about 6 o'clock in the morning. He said, why did you start so early? I said, because I was hungover. Now, as far as my half a pint was concerned, the couple of double shots I had in the tattletale at 6 in the morning did not count on today's drinking. They counted on yesterday's hangover. So then I would start on this today's drinking. And then along about noon, I'd think, well, hell, I won't want a full half a pint tomorrow. I think I'll get tomorrow's half a pint and have a drink out of it today, you know. And I'm getting smarter all the way along. And I identified, Kenny said, when you had your double, did that get rid of the hangover? I said, yes. And he said, did you keep drinking? And I said, yes, I did, but only because I wanted to drink. I didn't crave it. He said, there's a type of alcoholic who, once they start to drink, keeps slugging them down so fast that the craving doesn't have an opportunity to set in. I immediately saw myself in that category. I explained to him after the meeting that God wasn't going to be part of my life. It's very clear that you guys, now I'm not putting you down. I'm telling you, you guys are looking good and doing good. And if you can do that because you've conned yourself into the fantasy that God's helping you, then that works for you. But I have to live in the real world, which that real world that day was four half a pints and a lethal dose of Benzedrine. How's that for the real world? He said, well, let's don't worry about God. He said, I didn't think God was in my life, but he said, I found some people in AA who I could see their life was working. And I'd come to meetings to hear what they would say. And if it sounded good, I'd try to do that. And he said, they all said, don't drink and don't take Benny. I don't even know how he knew I took Benny's, unless he noticed I said the same things over and over real fast. I did that. I got drunk one more time, drunk as I've ever been, drunker than I'd ever been. And I stopped drinking on the 4th of August, 1972, and I came to meeting to listen. And I heard a guy named Tommy O'Mara say, if you make one mistake and brood about making that mistake, you've made two mistakes. Heard Ski from San Diego say, I was 36 years in learning that all the people that I hated didn't feel it. These were things that gave me hope. I couldn't do it, but I thought they were, and I was encouraged, and it brought me back. I heard Flo D, who had shingles and fell and broke her arm, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, she couldn't sleep. She sat on the foot of her bed, and she was enraged at God, and she shook her fist in God's face and said, why me? Said a voice come to her ear and said, because, Flo, there's something about you that pisses me off. And I loved Flo and I loved her God. You got to be sick for that to be true, but I was sick. I heard Archie Johnson say, I was so busy today wanting what I was getting that I didn't have time to worry about getting what I wanted. And in AA, we try to learn to live in the now, right now, and whatever's happening right now, love that, because that's what's going to happen anyway. And our biggest trouble is not loving what's going to happen anyway. And my thought was, well, let's stick Archie in the eye with a sharp stick. Let's see him love that. I went outside, and it is raining as hard as it can rain in the Pacific Palisades. And I've hated the rain ever since I wiped out the wheat crop. And when I got to my car, the thought came to me, love the rain, Howard. That's what Archie's talking about, because it's going to rain anyway. Now, if somebody would have said, God will give you just enough grace to love the rain, and then when it stops raining, to love it not raining. But I had that grace. Now, there was a ton of things that I wasn't able to do that with. But given the weather over, worked for me. I used to quit AA, every little whippersnitch, and I quit this one Saturday, and I went to the meeting. I always quit in the daytime. And then forgot I'd quit, and I went at night. I didn't miss any meeting, but I'd quit during the day. Damn thing don't work. I ain't going to grin like a baboon and say, and this one isn't wonderful. About halfway to Malibu, I was, isn't this wonderful, you know. And Don Gates was the speaker that night, and he said, if you're new in AA and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun. And you'll decide AA doesn't work. You're not going to drink, but you're not going to go to the meeting. Now, you don't go to the meeting for a little while. You'll go back to the bar, and you'll order a drink. And if you do that, and the bartender says, what's the matter? I thought you were going to AA. Don't AA work? Said, if you're not going to meetings, if you're not working the steps, be honest with the bartender and tell him you don't know if it works or not because you wouldn't try. And there was nothing in my head to pop off about that. I decided to do an inventory. I had had my dad in my head. He was an old German that used to spare the rod and spoil the child. And he just beat me half to death. He really did. And I never, I mean, I don't make you an alcoholic, but I never got where I liked it. I understand there's some people over in California that... We're close to 2 minutes. I know we are. And now I forgot where I was. But I went to the meetings. I worked the steps. When I did my fourth step, it was magic. My dad was not my problem. I was afraid. That's my problem. I'm just immobilized with fear. And I can't do anything unless I get the strength from being angry because I don't have anything else to turn to for strength. And I saw that. That's an outstanding thing. I was going to say a miracle, but It's divine order. It's just the way God created the world. You know, in this atmosphere right here, you could fly a 747 if you could get it in here and get it moving. Because the laws of aerodynamics are inherent in the atmosphere. And I've come to believe and know for me that there are spiritual principles that are an inherent part of my life that I can experience by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it gives my life lift. I took the equipment back. My sponsor tracked the equipment down. My wife and I went to the bank and borrowed the money, and I took her home, and I got the equipment and took it back. And my boss called me back in the next day. I took it to him and said, I stole this, and I'm bringing it back. And he said, go home, and I'll see you in the morning. And the next morning he said, I don't know where the equipment's been, but I know if it was stolen, I wouldn't have it, and I have it. Our procedures require us to fire anybody that steals from us. And so I don't want you to ever tell anybody about this. And I haven't. I mention it tonight because there's some new people. And this is the truth that I experienced. The next morning when I woke up, and I realized that the equipment thing is no longer weighing on me, the weight of the earth was off my shoulders, and I felt good. Now, if you remember your first drink, and you know how good you felt with your first drink, that's how good I felt that morning. And it was a clearer good feeling, because my thinking centers weren't muddled. Now, I don't know how long it lasted, but it embedded itself in my memory so that when I'm meditating, I can sometimes bring that memory in and re-experience it. And as I keep doing this stuff, more and more and more good feelings happen so that I wake in the morning feeling good, and know I'm going to have a good day. And I know it because I know my life is in divine order. There is no separation between me and my higher power. The big book describes God as the spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things. It says manifesting precise law in every aspect of all being. It's either everything or it's nothing. The big book describes God as an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence underlying the material world and life as we see it. There is no separation. My life has always been in divine order, but I didn't trust it. I came to AA. You have put me through the steps so that I can experience it and trust it. What a gift, and how grateful I am to you for that. I was reading a book on meditation. I've read a lot of them. Meditate every day, like for 100 years without missing. And that's a little exaggeration, but I don't miss meditation. I was reading this book on meditation, and it says, whatever way you experience God, that's the right way for you. If you intellectually convince yourself that God is present, that is right for you. Or if you just sit quietly and you experience God's presence in your feelings, that's right for you. But remember, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. This is my window. Thank you for letting me come.